Asian Avengers. So weak.
Asian Avengers. So weak. So fuckable, bro. You know? Whoa. There's five Asian guys together.
Did you ever go through a stealing phase?
Do I think everyone should have a gun? Maybe.
Or you can look me up. I don't care. I'll fight you. I don't care.
You want to get high as fuck? You like opium?
Hey, what's going on, everybody? Welcome to Asian Not Asian Podcast, the podcast where two Asian guys not from Asia talk about American issues no American cares about. I'm your host, Fumi Abe.
I'm Mike Nguyen.
And welcome. This is our 56th episode. If you are listening on iTunes, Spotify, SoundCloud, on your phone right now, please take a screenshot and post that shit on the Instagram and tag us at Asian Not Asian Pod, and we'll retweet it if it's a nice thing.
Yeah, if you say a mean thing, we'll probably also retweet it or regram it or whatever.
Probably gonna cry. And also leave us a review on iTunes if you're listening to that right now.
Please do that. That'd be great.
Yep. And also a quick shout out to our network, Listening Party, and Canal Street Radio. So check out those guys at Listening Party Presents and at Canal Street Market on Instagram. What's going on, man? How are you?
I'm good, man. I've been we've been busy.
Been busy. Yeah.
We were, you know, a lot of stuff out late doing stuff.
Yeah. You've been doing a lot more shows. That's
I know,
good. I'm so happy for you.
I'm trying to impress you, and now that I've been doing it, I'm like, why am I trying to impress Fumi? I'm like away from my wife all the time now. I'm like, this is all Fumi's fault.
Yeah, your wife hates me secretly, and I'm okay
with
it.
Openly, yeah, it's not
I know.
A secret.
I had a that's right. She sends me hate mail all the time. I had a weird show experience this week that I wanted to share with you because I know you've had a bunch of them because you're a weird comedian. Okay, so I think it's my fault, but the whole experience was just very surreal because we never think about it as like POC comedians. So like I was working on a bit, I was just working on it at the fucking Pear, at the Grizzly Pear, right?
The Grizzly Pear, for people don't know, it's like on the same street as the Cellar, the most famous club in the world.
Yeah.
But it is like a world away from the Cellar. Because it is like a piece of crap.
It's gotten better, but they just basically like, if you can't get into the Cellar and you want to pay like $3 for a comedy show, you come here.
You can come in there.
The crowd is drunk.
Weird.
They're all tourists. Sometimes they don't even speak English. It's the Wild West.
It's a mess.
It's not the best environment for comedy all the time. Sometimes it's good, but I was working on this bit about white girls. You know, I'm dating one
white girls.
Yes, and I just had a personal experience where my girlfriend, she was very greasy, and I was just trying to talk about white girls being greasy. And before I did this joke, I just took a survey. I was like, "Am I allowed to?" I know this is gonna sound offensive, but I just wanted to, you know, quick survey to anybody who's ever dated white girls. Like, is this a thing that I can talk about? And some people are like, "Yeah, it is a thing." And this one guy was like, he got real mad. He's like, "No, like that's racist. That's not a thing." White girls are amazing.
was he like an American guy?
I think he was an American. Well, yeah, American white guy with like that classic like alt-right haircut.
Got it. Oh, yeah. I thought maybe.
No.
Oh, okay.
He looked like Richard Spencer kind of type.
Oh, here we go.
But I thought he was just trying to be funny, so I just started doing it.
White girls are amazing.
And I just he said white girls are amazing.
Oh my god.
I was so scared at the time. I didn't even realize how funny that statement was. So I did the bit or whatever, and it like got some laughs. And you know, I'm still like working on it.
It wasn't
perfect.
It's fine.
You know. But when I got off and the host went on, he started complaining again.
To the next comic?
To the host. He was like, "What is this, man?" He's like, "You're just gonna talk shit about white girls this whole time?"
Aww.
And the host was like, you know, trying to calm it down. And I felt really bad, you know? Because, you know, like, I think we all have jokes about, like, kind of teasing at, like, white culture here and there.
Yeah.
And then, like, most of the time it's justified just because, like, we're coming from an educational standpoint. You know, it's like, hey, this is, like, something shit that happened to me. And I want to, you know, make light of it.
Yeah.
Make fun of it to kind of get over it. But, you know, sometimes people get offended, mm-hmm. and I actually pride myself on being a non-offensive comedian. Like, I've rarely had people say my material was offensive, but, you know, this wasn't really worked out, so, like, it's very possible it hurt some feelings.
Well, I mean, fucking white people are sensitive about race, dude.
Mm.
They're the most sensitive about race.
You think so?
Absolutely.
Mm.
Like, that, in the way that they don't want to talk about it sometimes at all. Like anything you bring up about it is going to be like, so for my story, I did a terrible show and to be fair, I was doing terribly and I did one of my best jokes, which is about how black teenagers like how I dress.
Yes.
So, and as soon as you bring up, black,
just the word
at all, people are going to get like, "What are you saying?" You know what I'm saying? And this lady was like upset about it. She was, black people are never offended about race jokes, ever. They're, because like,
well,
hold on here.
It depends on the content.
Hold on here. Yeah. No, they don't get offended about talking about it.
Oh, right.
They don't get offended about, like, can you bring up race? Matter of fact, they're probably like, oh my God, finally, someone's talking about it.
Yeah.
I don't know why I said in that voice. But like,
we're going to edit that out and put an Asian accent on it.
You know, sometimes people just like get real stiff about like that sort of thing. And they get, you know, like, oh, you know. So I think definitely that's the game, baby.
I know. Well, you know me, on this podcast, I'm always trying to protect white people on this podcast.
We do protect white people a lot.
Yeah, on this podcast, yeah.
We do, why?
Well, you know, we want more listeners, you know, I think.
Well, you know, like, I mean... You know what happens to I'm sorry that I kind of scrunched up your butthole for a second.
Yeah.
You know, because I said something kind of, you know, you found to be a little off color, but maybe you stopped shooting us. How about that? That'd be sweet.
Yeah, I got real.
I'm sorry.
That got really real.
But at the same time, like, for reals, like, you know, like, this is a podcast. You could always take your headphones off, right? You know?
Yeah. In live comedy, they can't. I mean, I guess they could leave, but
I don't know. It's just like this is you know, what do you want to talk about, huh? You want to talk about airline food?
But I would say a lot of people who you describe, like sensitive people who are sensitive to race jokes, they want to talk about airline food. They want to talk about stop signs. They want to talk about they want to talk about why the table only has four legs. They want to talk about that. But like our audience, the Asian Not Asian podcast audience, when they come to Hack City out here, they don't want to hear that shit.
Yeah,
they want to hear your sufferings.
Yeah,
that's why like when we book like straight white dudes on our show, they don't always do that well. Not because they're not funny.
No.
But our audience,
they don't hear about the
our
tables.
Audience wants to hear like your personal life story. Like, when did you struggle? What was funny about that looking back, you know, 10 years? You know what I mean? So anyways, I'm probably going to stop doing that joke about white girls being greasy because very offensive. But
also,
you
I'm
know.
Very greasy. So
yeah, you know you're what? Also greasy too.
I'm super greasy.
Everybody's greasy.
Are you not greasy?
No.
You know what
I'm
it
very
is?
Clean.
Is this one of those like... civilized Asian things versus jungle Asian things?
I think so.
Where I'm real greasy.
Your earwax is different than mine too.
Yes, my earwax is different than his, and we did a study.
Yes. Well, enough about earwax. Let's. You know what? Before we start the show, we have to do our little Patreon game. Yes. So, listeners, we always give a shout out to our newest Patreon subscribers. So, if you're not a member, please check us out at patreon.com/AsianNotAsianPod, and you can have access to bonus content. So, here are the newest subscribers for this week. We got Katie Wong, Chinese. Zhang Nguyen.
Woo, this is, oh no, no, this guy's mad. This guy's mad Vietnamese. My Vietnamese, cousin's name is Zhang.
Zhang? That's like a cool like rap name. I like that.
Yeah, or like a Chinese wing store.
delicious Zhang.
James Yoshizawa, finally a Japanese person. Thank God.
Man, that's like super Japanese. That's like a fake Japanese name.
No, it's very real.
Ah.
Yes, and he's coming for you.
I knew it.
We got Maria, that's my girlfriend. I made her do it.
I love it.
You know. Whatever. Mikkei Wu, W-U. Chinese.
Mikkei Wu, yeah, Chinese.
Yeah.
Wu, yeah.
Andy Chan.
Chan, Chinese.
Chinese. Kevin Louis.
Oh, okay,
that's a middle name.
And this guy sent us a very nice message.
Yeah.
Did you read it?
Yeah, about how we shat on Pak.
Yeah. Fair point. And then he was like, "You'll never guess what kind of race I am." I think he's Chinese. You know why? My friend's name's Louis also.
Ooh.
It's a weird thing where sometimes Lui is spelled Louie, like Louis, you know, like Louis Anderson.
Yeah, right? Louis.
It's a real clever Chinese trick.
Try to assimilate.
I like it.
Okay, and then finally we have Mei Li Ngo.
Mei Li. See, this kind of tripped me up because Mei Li, that sounds Chinese, but Ngo is a Vietnamese name.
Well, perhaps a Vietnamese Chinese person.
Oh.
Yeah, they got those because of history.
No. Yeah.
So listeners, again, please check us out at patreon.com/AsianNotAsianPod and you get a shout out if you donate to our show. All right, enough with this bullshit. Let's get into the show.
Let's do it.
Our guest today, we are so excited to have her. I can't believe we hit her up on DMs. I can't believe she responded.
I honestly can't believe that she's here.
I didn't think you were actually gonna come.
For like we seriously thought that you weren't gonna come.
No,
we had on like it was like a first date and we were just like ready with our flowers and we're like, you know, we had combed our hair and shit. And then the waiter's like, sir, would you like another glass of wine? And I'm like,
she's coming, okay? She's coming. So I just want to go over who she is. So she's the founder and executive director of the nonprofit organization Period, which is a youth-run organization that focuses on menstrual hygiene, which she founded at the age of 16 and is now the largest youth-run NGO in women's health and one of the largest, fastest growing ones in the US. She's the author of the book Period Power, a manifesto for the menstrual movement. She was on Team Vogue 21 under 21.
Mm-hmm.
That's the hardest one to get, I think. I'm trying to go for that 30 under 30, almost 30. So if you know any writers, please DM me.
Yeah, I'm trying to be successful before I die. That one. Still alive list.
She had a TED Talk. That's pretty dope.
Yeah, that's cool.
And she was just at South by Southwest, which is something that we're trying to do.
That's right.
Soon. That's pretty dope. So, hey, man, let's give a warm welcome to the very accomplished Nadia Okamoto.
Yay! Hi. Thanks for being on the show.
Of course.
Thank
of
you
course.
For coming. I know you had some train troubles, but I really appreciate you. You making
not
it.
It's so nice to be back in Chinatown. I haven't been here for a little while, but I grew up near here, so I feel this sort of like homey sense.
Really? Where?
Yeah, so I grew up on Canal Street, I think.
What?
Or right on Canal and Broadway. It was at 365 Broadway, I think.
What year was this?
Like, this was a long time ago, like age maybe like 7 to 9. Yeah, so a long time
2000,
ago.
2000, like 4 or 5 ish, something like that. I have no idea.
Yeah, until 2007 about. Yeah, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah,
wow.
So it was interesting. I went to PS 234, which is right downtown as well, and so this is sort of where I grew up. Yeah.
Wow, that's
crazy.
Dude,
do you have any like fond memories? Where did you play? Can you play around here?
You know, not really. Like, I remember even at the playground we weren't allowed to really have a playground at school because of the like potential injuries. So our field / where we had recess was just a huge field of concrete. Like just concrete. Yeah, and they used to give out hula hoops, and then I remember when I was in second grade they took away the hula hoops because people were like getting hurt with them. So we literally would just be in concrete like playing tag.
So
just like a whole thing of concrete, like little groups, like doing, you know, duck goose. So
it's like you're like in jail.
But it was super interesting because then we moved to Portland, Oregon, where it was completely opposite. Different, like lots of green, lots of trees. And I remember like when I first moved out and they were like, okay, go have recess. There was a playground and I did not know what to do with myself because I had never played with one in school ever.
You were just so used to like going to the yard and doing a bench press.
Well, I was a really bad kid when I lived in New York because I think,
of course, you know,
my parents were fighting, and I lived in Chinatown kind of before it became what it is now. And you know, I remember,
was this a bad neighborhood?
You know, it wasn't a bad neighborhood, but the kids who still lived here were very misbehaved. I'd say that because it was still turning into what Soho is now. But I remember I would get suspended regularly in school. Yeah, and I was such a different kid. Like we had a little like what we called a gang in PS 234, and we would get into fist fights. I don't have real front teeth because I got them knocked out.
Really? Let me see.
Wait.
I was a fucking bad kid. And it was totally. And I was like the kid where like my friends who are girls would be like, oh, my mom says, you know, you probably have a hard life at home because of how you act. Like, I was not a good kid, and I would get sent to the principal's office on a daily basis
for fighting, for insulting.
And I would only wear like, I just wanted to wear Air Jordans, big basketball shorts, and like oversized shirts. Like, I was such a different kid
tight.
In New York.
Dude, you know? That's
the thing about, quite oversized.
That's the thing about New York kids is they have such a different experience than like going to school in the suburbs. Like, you probably didn't have tetherball. You didn't play wall ball, you know?
No, no.
You're out there beating up bitches, and that's crazy.
Yeah, you grew up really fast.
Yeah.
You know what's funny is that that they were like, these kids are so bad, but let's not give them hula hoops. You know? like, this is going to be too crazy for them. Let's just make sure they just beat the shit out of each other still.
Oh my God.
So, are you...
And I went to like a rather wealthy school.
Right, not like
a super
rough
school.
Like,
I was in PS 234, which is like right next to Washington Market. So, considering the demographic, it was really interesting because I remember my school bus was me and like the other Asian kids who lived in Chinatown, right?
And then
a mix of like kids who lived on Wall Street. Like, it was a super interesting
so
mix.
Like in between. Interesting.
Yeah.
So, are you Chinese?
So I'm half Japanese for sure.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then this is actually something I'm still figuring out because I know my family is half Chinese. Like, my mom's side is Chinese, but they're from Taiwan.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I actually still struggle. Like, do I say Taiwanese or Chinese? Because I think they say Chinese because I know everyone Taiwan's ethnically, but I actually have no idea. Yeah, it's also I'm a political thing. I'm very disconnected from my Asian background. Very interesting.
Do you speak Japanese?
No.
Wow, really?
No.
Yeah. Your parents, are they like second, third generation Asian Americans?
So my mom was born here. My dad was born in Fukuoka in Japan.
Oh, shit. Wow. Damn. Man, I was hoping I could do some Japanese with you.
No, I wish.
Damn.
Well, instead, we're just going to beat the shit out of you for me. Take this hula hoop.
No, I'm very, and I don't really have contact with my grandparents anymore.
Gotcha.
So my family really has become just me, my mom, and my sisters.
That's so interesting.
So I like cannot name a single Chinese holiday beyond or Asian holiday beyond like Chinese New Year. Like I very don't
right,
know.
Right. You don't get like otoshidama and stuff like that. You know what I'm talking about? Little like New Year's money.
Oh no! I mean, I know what it is from like TV.
Oh my god!
Yeah, like I'm very
you like straight up Fresh Prince yourself, dog. It's like you like grew up in the rough neighborhood, and they're like, we got to get out of here.
And we went to Portland.
And
I
you
did.
Went to Portland.
And Portland is the whitest major city in the U.S.
Oh
right?
Yeah, totally.
So it was it was a definitely a big culture shock in terms of like growing up in Chinatown for a little bit, and then. Going to Portland.
Were you still beating up kids
over
there?
Were you still running?
No.
Did you run the school?
No, so
you got
I ran the school when I was in New York. Like, I definitely, like, I was the kid who, like, all the teachers knew about, but, like, not as, in a good way.
Yeah,
the interesting thing is I was always really good in school, no matter what. Like, I was always really good in school. But then... And that's why, like, I would... There's so many reasons I should have gotten expelled. Like, I remember I brought a box cutter to school once.
Oh, my God.
And I was showing it to all to my guy friends, and they were like, you should be expelled. And my teachers were rallied and kept me in school because I was a really good student.
Because you were a good student.
Right? So, but as soon as I moved to Portland, I was complete opposite. I grew my hair out because I had, like, a fucking short bowl cut.
Yeah.
But I grew my hair out. I started wearing dresses. I, like, would, you know, never broke the rules. I was always very teacher's pet as soon as we moved to Portland.
Why did you make that change?
Yeah, I mean, it definitely wasn't conscious. But I think a lot of it was the change in my family home life. Mm-hmm, like, I think when we lived in New York, it was very tumultuous and chaotic. Mm-hmm, and my dad was very abusive. And as soon as we moved out to Portland, it also wasn't like that's not how you gain respect in Portland. You know, in Portland, you gain respect for being, you know, more
growing,
progressive.
Yeah,
like
keeping your poop in your own yard.
But like loving nature. Like suddenly I would tell everyone like I love camping even though I really didn't. Like it was like you like even in high school, I remember the cool kids were the ones who wore, you know, Teva sandals and like went rock climbing.
Yeah.
And in New York you gain respect by
wearing,
hitting each other.
Yeah.
So it was
having box cutters.
So it's just a different culture.
Yeah.
So I think that was just the change, yeah.
Dude, that's insane. Do those teachers know who you are now and how you start a nonprofit and stuff like that?
Because
you're hitting people, they probably never thought, oh, this person's going to help the world.
Yeah, and I think like my mom is really good friends with my kindergarten teacher, and I know that they joke about how like when I was younger, these just horror stories of I would walk down the hall and the kids would be on the line and they would slowly fall behind me crying because I said something mean, like you're fat, like your mom died. Like just this really
just, like,
strange.
Some people.
Yeah. And they tell these stories and they're like, now they see that I'm doing like social justice work and all this stuff. And I actually, when I, after I gave my TED talk, I like weird things about like success in my own life. Like whenever I get a success, I feel really sad and like apologetic.
Why?
You know, I think it's an imposter syndrome or like not really knowing why it's happening. But I remember I gave my first TED talk and then like did not really celebrate, but the next day I actually went through the list of people that I really bullied in early elementary school and I sent them messages and I said like sorry, and they all had sort of the same reaction. They were like, you know, it's okay, I know you had a lot going on at home.
My god, that's so crazy. So you moved to Portland and I watched a bunch of your YouTube videos. This is like a very key moment in your life and almost like, you know, one of the reasons why you started this organization, which we'll kind of get into later. But tell us, like, what was that like when you kind of moved up there and you were a little bit financially unstable, right? And, you know, you were commuting to a school that was, like, very far away.
Well, that wasn't right away after I moved there. So I moved when I was about nine, right?
Okay.
But it was rough. Like, we moved out. My mom, we were pretty well off when I was in New York. My mom was in corporate law. I was born her first year at Columbia Law School.
Wow. Okay.
And my dad was an artist. And by the time we had left, he and my mom had started a really successful ice sculpting business, which is actually still really successful today. Hmm. It's called Okamoto Studio. So we were pretty well off. And then my mom ended up giving up a lot and to kind of escape to better, more peaceful life.
Sure.
We moved out to Portland, Oregon, and we moved out with no home. My mom had like not really secured her job yet. And we moved in like to the basement of the one person we knew in Portland.
Why Portland specifically?
You know, so my mom, I think the way she tells it is really that she was really struggling here in New York and trying to save my sisters and I and protect us. And this one friend we had who like had taught my sisters in Sunday school, was sending her beautiful pictures of the Portland cherry blossoms. And I think it just represented like more nature. And
yeah.
It's like gay the opposite, couple, basically. More progress.
Yeah, sort of like, I think Portland felt like literally the other side of the country, but in a totally different atmosphere. So we moved out there and I remember being so fucking mad. I was so mad at my parents in every way. I actually didn't know my dad was abusive until I was about 17 years old, actually. So we saw the relationship, but we moved out when I was 9 and sort of got back on our feet slowly. And then when I was 15, my mom ended up parting ways with her job. And that's when we entered what I call our time of transition, which was several months of living without a home of our own. And that's when we actually were sort of couch surfing with that same couple that we had moved in with. And it was during that time that I had this like 2-hour public transportation commute to school and ended up talking to a lot of these homeless women.
So then for you, I mean, I feel like with kids kind of like normalize things really fast.
Yeah.
So did you think, oh, well, I guess I gotta sleep on this couch and I gotta like take the bus? Or did you think, this is really crazy and like, this is like, you know, is this how my life's gonna be? Were you worried about that? Or were you just kind of like,
yeah, for sure. I mean, by then I knew what it meant to like not be able to afford your place anymore. Yeah. And like, but, and we like to basically afford basic necessities, we were renting out our apartment to, you know, be able to afford food and stuff.
Right.
I think it was also the sort of thing where with my mom, you could see how much she was working so hard. Yeah. And like really, I think, hating that she had to put us in that situation, that to us it was like, don't talk about it. Like, don't like recognize that we have to work hard and that we're saving, but don't complain.
Got
about
it.
Where we are. And of course that was hard to do, and my family's very open, so the complaining happened every once in a while, but it was something that we didn't really, it wasn't something where you complained about it a lot.
Did you get like, did kids pick on you at school for that?
No. So I went to a very exclusive private school called Cat and Gable, like very over $30,000 a year. And
oh my
I was
God.
A scholarship
Whoa.
Kid. Yeah.
So you went for free.
Yeah. So I was a scholarship kid there. But you know, it was the thing where none of my friends knew.
Got
you know, like
it.
You learn to like make up the lies about why they can't come over to your house, why you can't have sleepovers at your house.
Oh, it's
like,
so sad.
Yeah. So, but it was more like, it was, you just hit it.
Yeah.
But I think it was really confusing because, like, I know, you know, my family had one car. We had always public transportation. Some of my friends had drivers and planes and multiple homes. And
wow.
So it was definitely like a time when I was really thinking about privilege as a spectrum, because I would be at school and feel so disadvantaged. Like I would not get lunch, and my school had no free and reduced lunch program until my sisters and I spoke up. Right.
Yeah.
And then I would be on my way to school and like talk to all these homeless people where my bus stop was, where there's like 10 homeless shelters in a 2-block radius. And I would hear their stories of not having anything.
Right.
To them, I felt really privileged. Right. Mm. So I think that's when I started getting more passionate about like service and stuff, because of the disparities with those two conflicting worlds.
Yeah, absolutely.
The Fresh Prince analogy only continues because you went to a private school. That's crazy, man. So you start this, you didn't start, how did that come about? Like, for me and Fumi, we're trying to start, like, the paperwork alone scares me with starting a business. So how did you come about like developing this idea and then like making it happen? Because I really think like that's a crazy thing, just have an idea but then to actually make something happen.
Yeah, especially at age 16, right?
Yeah. So I mean I got really passionate about period poverty really fast. Like, it was basically hearing their stories of using toilet paper, cardboard to take care of their periods, and then through Google searches learned about, you know, periods being the number one reason why girls miss school in developing countries.
Wow.
And learning about the tampon tax in the US. So in 2014,
that's crazy. Hold on here. Okay, yeah, no, go, yeah, continue.
No, so I was just saying, like, kind of on the global scale, learning that it's this number one reason why girls miss school in developing countries. A girl's first period is the single event that leads them dropping out of school, getting married early, undergoing female genital mutilation.
Yep.
And then in the US, learning about it being a leading cause of absenteeism for girls here, hearing these stories of homeless women using trash to take care of their periods, and then learning about the tampon tax, which in 40 states existed, so that there is the sales tax on period products, considering them non-essential goods, so like luxury items. But products like Rogaine and Viagra were considered necessity, so didn't have that sales tax.
Do you know why? Like, do you know the history of why that is? Like, how is this possible?
It's just because men were making the laws. Like, to them, like, we still talk to people who believe that they're necessity, who believe they're luxuries, right? Like, it's just a fundamental misunderstanding of what a menstruation is.
Right.
My girlfriend had a weird thing recently. So she's very passionate about that topic, and she bought tampons at a CVS or something, and they taxed her. So she said, oh, actually, this isn't supposed to be taxed. I think in New York, it's not taxed
anymore.
Not anymore, right? So there was a recent law that was passed.
Yeah.
Right. So she corrected him. And then the guy was like, oh, my manager's not here, so I can't do anything about it. Like, he didn't, you know, they just that
mentality.
Right, so he doesn't care.
Yeah.
He does. There's no empathy. He doesn't care. He doesn't understand what that text represents. And so she was really upset and just got it somewhere else. But I think, you know, to your point, like, why does it, why is it still a thing? It's because a lot of dudes don't care or know. Or there's no communication there.
Yeah. Or they didn't even know what the products are.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah,
I think that's a big thing that, like, even in our conversations with powerful legislators, is explaining to them what a tampon is before we can talk about the tampon.
Yo,
tax.
Bros don't even know what tampons are?
Yeah.
Damn.
What do you mean they don't know what it is?
No, they're, like, they've never seen it.
Do they know
it?
Where babies come from?
you're talking about 15-year-old boys? Or you're talking about, like,
no,
men?
No, I'm talking about older men, because think about it. Like, sometimes sex ed talks about periods, right?
Yeah.
But usually, for the most part, sex ed is taught in gender segregated classrooms.
Right,
so
right.
The boys never have to learn about it, unless they have, like, sisters and stuff. But
yeah.
If no one's talking about periods in their space, they won't learn about it in school.
That's very true. I had a sister, that's why
I
knew about it.
Yeah. But like, for like, even my co-founder, when my co-founder and I started working together, I was 16, and I sort of identified him as someone who was very business oriented and organized, and that's how we connected.
I saw the video with his tie on. And
when we first went on our trip to go get period products from the store, I had to unwrap one and explain how it worked.
Oh,
you know, so but he had no sisters, his mom didn't talk to him about it, and when it's in gender segregated classrooms, periods aren't talked about in the boys' classroom, right? So he had no reason to know what it was.
Yep.
So that's kind of, I think, like, that's why I'm like, of course there's a tampon tax, because there's just no discussion around it.
What was your sexual education experience like at your schools? Because, like, Midwest, super conservative, I'm sure it's very different from your high school your high school, too.
It's funny, when I was in grade school, we got they walked everybody into the thing. And actually, it was really good.
Where did you grow up?
I grew up in Southern California.
Okay.
So it was really good in, like, fifth grade.
Both genders.
It was
combined.
And they did divide it eventually, but they did teach they did show all the boys a tampon, and they put it in water to show it got really big.
Whoa.
And everyone was like, whoa, this is crazy.
I love that.
So that was, I mean, it was really cool. And I mean, just to this day, I don't know how everyone wasn't laughing when we were talking about penises. I mean, I'm sorry, that's a funny word.
I mean, especially to a boy.
Yeah,
sure.
Exactly. Yeah. But everybody was very serious about it, and it was cool. But then in high school, something happened, because then we had another talk in health, and we were, like, you know, fucking 10th graders, right?
Yeah.
And they gave us the really hard wait until you're married thing.
Even as a 10th grader,
I was like, this is incredible bullshit, right?
Right.
Yeah.
And for some reason, 5th grade, fortunately, we got, like, a much better, very honest talk. And it was the school nurse. The school nurse was like, this is what sex is and all that stuff. So that was cool. But then later on, some, like, weird Christians somehow infiltrated my public high school.
So that was more my experience. Is like, we, in 5th grade, we had the talk, but we were segregated, like you said. The boys got, like, our little goodie bag, which had, like, a deodorant, which, like, goodie Asian bag. Dudes don't even use deodorant. I don't know if you guys knew that.
I've never used it.
So
yes, but I'm real greasy.
I was like, I don't need this, throw it in the trash. But it, you know, they, like, talked to us about, like, wet dreams and stuff like that, but they always beat around the bush. And, like, I remember we were allowed to write down a question anonymously and ask the nurse about stuff.
Yeah.
And so I wrote down, what is a wet dream? Because I didn't understand what it was, because they wouldn't use the word sex, like, they didn't want to, because it's still, like, a very conservative. I grew up in Ohio, just FYI. And she never answered my question, and I didn't really understand anything until, like, middle school health class, when they, like, got more into that shit.
But they're more open about, I think educators are more open about sex than they are about periods.
Absolutely.
Even, right? Like, I think I learned about periods from my mom at a very early age, and then got in trouble for telling everyone else what periods and sex were.
Oh, really?
getting in trouble, like, even that concept
is
messed
up. All public schools, when you talk about sex ed or like bodies, you have to get permission slips, right, from parents to make sure that parents are okay talking about it. So in my school, in fifth grade, we were separated. But the girls, I think it creates this culture of, then you only talk about periods behind closed doors.
You don't talk
about it in co-ed spaces. So it's not an open conversation. And you don't learn about, like, what is the experience like? What is period poverty, and what's it like when you don't have these products? You just learn, like, this is going to happen once a month. Here's a tampon. Here's a pad. Not even, like, menstrual cups and other reusables, but here's just, like, basic things, like, go get them. Right? So I think it's very like that. And then I remember in high school, you combine. You don't talk about periods. You don't really talk about puberty, but you talk about condoms, right? And you talk about contraception or abstinence, right? So I think like it's interesting to see how much more stigmatized periods are in comparison to sex.
100%. Yeah, it's just part of the education. So like that's why we all think like that as adults. Yeah.
I'm uncomfortable. How about you guys? No. So is a lot of your work even just getting people on page one?
Yeah.
You know, just to understand.
So officially, like our mission is like to end period poverty and period stigma through service, education, and advocacy. And that education piece is changing the way people think, talk, and learn about periods through education, right? Mm. And I really feel like, so in addressing period poverty, our short-term solution is distributing a fuck ton of period products, right? So we've addressed over 500,000.
That's a professional unit of measurement.
A fuck ton.
A fuck ton. That's the official.
I believe that's
3,000 fuck tons.
How many crates is that? About 17 fuck tons.
But so we've addressed over 500,000 periods through product distribution. And so whatever like 500,000 times 18 is, that's how many products we've distributed.
Damn.
And then the long-term solution is policy, right? So we're passing legislation now at the local level to get period products free and accessible in schools, and repealing the tampon tax, talking about how food stamps should cover period products. But the bridge to getting from service to systemic change is this cultural change to make people know that this is a basic necessity, right? So I think I feel the cultural change is the necessary component towards longer term change.
Yeah, I watched some of your talks, and you have this like interesting, you have a manifesto, right, about this whole thing and the way that you it leads into equality. Can you talk a little bit? I don't know if you touched about it just now, but like how does it lead into equality?
Yeah, so the way I think of this work is I don't think that talking about periods and addressing periods is the end goal, right? Sure. Like that's just a means to the end, right? The overall goal is gender equality and breaking the cycle of poverty to achieve global development, right?
Yep.
And when you look at how gender equality is defined by the UN, the World Health Organization, all of the measurable, you know, ways you measure gender equality falls into these four buckets of education, healthcare, economic mobility, and representation in politics and decision-making. And so I've already talked about how periods are a huge barrier for access in economic mobility and education. It's a matter of healthcare. And also periods throughout history have been used as a reason for why women can't hold high positions of power or like even hold like the front lines of combat, right? It was a joke of like why Hillary Clinton couldn't hold office. It's still a joke of like women being too hormonal and having more maternal instincts in their cycle and not being able to like run the military.
Right.
And in many Asian countries, there's even like menstrual leave policy where you can get sick days for your period, right? Mm. But it actually creates this barrier of power for women because it's used as a reason for why they can't hold those higher leadership positions if they're going to be missing so much
missing
work for
days.
The period, right?
Right?
So I think that you can look at every way that gender equality is measured and see how periods are a strict barrier, right? And we can build as many schools as we want for girls, but if they're missing a school a quarter of the time and then when they hit 13 they drop out of school, you have to address periods to get rid of that barrier for entry, right? So to me, that's why if we're talking about breaking the cycle of poverty, fighting for gender equality, you inherently have to talk about periods as a key to achieve success in all those areas.
Man, you just dropped this is like the Matrix but with periods. I'm just like it's all connecting together, you know what I'm saying? Like yeah, all the different you're connecting. Okay, then John F. Kennedy led to this.
All
your conspiracy theories and then all the lizard people. Yeah,
I think that's why Period as an organization has been successful and grown really organically, because we found ways to relate it to whatever someone cares about. And that's really why I wrote this book. I was like, you can throw something at me of like, oh, well, I think this is a more important issue and I can try to relate it back to periods, right? Whether it be like climate change. And that's the one I get a lot. Like, why aren't you focusing on climate change? That's more pressing. I'm like, well, that is some of the work that we do, because the average tampon or pad that's disposable takes 5 to 8 centuries to decompose, and the average menstruator uses 17,000 of them, right? So like there's sustainability work within this space, there's gender inclusivity work. You'll hear that I use the term menstruators because we acknowledge that trans men and non-binary people get their periods. So this is such an intersectional movement because it's a biological phenomenon that inherently happens for every person who's assigned female at birth, right, for the most part. So it's so inclusive. It touches everyone's life, and it's the reason why reproduction is possible too. That's why it is so intersectional.
Go ahead.
I love that you're so, I can feel your passion when you're talking about this. You're like Eminem at the end of the movie.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. Like, you're boom, like boom, a hype
boom,
man.
Boom,
yeah,
boom,
exactly.
Boom,
equality,
bam.
Yeah. Little rabbit.
I want to talk a little bit about you know, you're very young. You're 21.
Yes.
Right? And
which is so lit. I just turned 21.
Congratulations.
Did you say it's lit?
Should we do some shots?
But you started business when you're 16, like in high school. I want to talk a little about, like, so you have this passion, you have this goal, right? But it's like, how do you start a company when you're in high school?
You Google it.
Yeah, I did read that, but it's also like, don't you have other responsibilities as a high schooler, like studying for the SATs or like going to shit?
I mean, to be honest, I was very obsessed with work and like doing more at a really young age, because I think even elementary school was the way I got out of home, right? Like, it was the way I got away from all the chaos and abuse at home. So I would like, I loved being in school and loved being in after school. And when I was in high school, I did everything. I was in like 4 sports, did professional ballet, and then was in 16 clubs and leading most of them. Boys varsity baseball team. I was always very involved in extracurriculars, and I think starting a nonprofit was sort of just to tack onto that. And you know, it was really dangerous, actually, because I got really obsessed with the work.
Yeah.
Because part of the reason I think I became so interested in activism was because it came from a really painful place, right? Like, at 16, I was starting this nonprofit, but also getting out of a really abusive relationship where, like, sexual assault and rape were a really regular part of my life. And I think to have that be a regular part of your life and feel so powerless in that, and then have activism and extracurriculars where I felt very empowered, right? I think became very addicting, But I think for me, to start it was like, we Googled questions. What is a nonprofit? What is the IRS? What is board of directors? And I Googled how to become a 501c3 nonprofit. We didn't even hire a lawyer. Me and my co-founder sat down, filled out the whole form ourselves in like 8 hours and got our parents to sign. And then we became a nonprofit. And I started a business a little while ago. We Googled everything, hired lawyers, like,
These are all things I need to Google as well.
I know. I was literally before the podcast, we're like, let's,
it takes 10 minutes.
We're like, should we do an LLC? How do we do that?
You just take 10 minutes. You just go online, you register with Secretary of State. Like, it's so fast. It is so easy to start a business or start a nonprofit. And I think that those words are just labels. Those are literally just legal labels that say what sort of bank account and how you'll be taxed, right?
What's a bank account?
We just, we recently spoke at like a scholarship event for, you know, for like Asian Pacific Islander students in the US, and I love that what you just said about the Google thing, where it's like you have this grandiose goal.
Oh yeah.
And that word is very scary, right? Like, oh, nonprofit, like how do you register under the Secretary of State, blah blah blah. But you just Googled it and you're like, okay, I gotta do these 5 things. Okay, let's do these 5 things. You just break it down, and once you break things down, it's very easy to, not easy, but it's, that goal seems more attainable.
Yeah, and
you
know? I also think, like, with community organizing, you don't even need to be a nonprofit. Like, nonprofit just means, just changes the way you're taxed, right? So unless you're bringing in lots of money, you can just start something, right? And so, and I think that's something that I learned very early on, was that getting a nonprofit status was just a legal document that informed how we were going to be taxed, right? So I think that there's, it creates this like understood barrier, but it really isn't, you know? I think, Google has been like the reason, the way I started this organization, how I learned how to run for office, how to start a book. Like, I remember when I wanted to write a book, I just Googled
how to write a book.
Awesome. Like, literally, like, templates for book proposals. Like, I found my literary agent online just by Googling and making a spreadsheet of every cold email I could find.
Shouts to Google algorithm. So at Nadia, you on Tinder, dog?
No.
What's your like? Yes, are you too busy? No, you're not too busy. You're a hustler. But you know what I'm saying? You know what I'm saying?
Like,
you're 21. Like, do you get
to still be
21?
Yes.
You know, you got your Jordans.
You have your Jordans. Like, do you dance and stuff? Like, were you having fun?
Okay, I'm really into dancing. So, I mean, dance was something I did a lot for a long time.
Not like professionally, but like out with your girls. Yes. Boom.
You know what I'm saying?
I don't go
Shotskis.
Out that often, but I'm going to a rave tonight.
Thank you.
You know
I'm
what?
Held in. That's just exciting.
That's the rave is the overachiever clubbing.
That's true.
Because you're like, oh, yo, I need as much clubbing as possible.
Exactly. It's like this.
Do you find that hard? I mean, like, you know, personally, like, you know,
I mean, I used to go out to, like, all summer when my girlfriends were all living here, we would go to comedy clubs all the time. We went to the Lantern, like, all the free comedy.
Are you serious?
I'm obsessed with the Lantern.
Are you serious?
We perform at the Lantern all the time.
Are you serious? Yeah. Okay, because they have five.
You're better than that.
I love the Lantern because I got really into, like, it's just such a
Please
not,
don't do comedy.
Do you remember, like, any comedians?
Okay, so I'm really obsessed with Alexandra Hart. Do you know her?
Yeah,
she like helps run it.
Yeah.
So I love her.
She's great.
And because she found out what I do and was honestly really open. And then also the Lantern like doesn't card for so everyone. Ah!
Like, wow! By the way, Mantra's now shut down.
Yeah, you just destroyed their business with your followers.
I fell in love with the lantern just because it was such an open. And I mean, most of the comedy is really bad, but
yeah. Yes, that's what I wanted to hear.
And also, really racist.
It is racist. Yeah, sure.
Like me when I go up there
talking about greasy white girls.
But I love the lantern. But I mean, I definitely go up, but I think it does get hard because I got really bored with going out, especially in college, because if you drink too much, you don't remember it, so it's useless. But also, I think as a workaholic, I would count the time that I was missing as an opportunity cost for what I could be doing. Right?
So, you could always be filling out more Excel sheets.
Yeah, exactly. I think even when I'm going out, I'm like, I could be doing something more. And it's actually something I'm trying to work on because I even have that mentality with friends. I'm like, is this lunch with a friend worth it?
Yeah, yeah.
Like,
who do I need to hang out with?
Is this a real friend?
Is this the best use of my time?
Yeah. And I think that especially when you're public profile gets bigger, everyone wants to be your friend for like the wrong reasons.
Sure.
So I think it's even been learning like who do I want to give my time to in this social sense.
Oh my god, Drake wrote a song about that. Who are your real friends?
But I think going out is the same thing because I think like the going out is like does not have a long term effect for me. Like I do have memories where I like look back a year ago and I'm like that was such a fun time and like that is worth it. But I also remember a lot of times where like I went out and I don't really remember anything specific about the day and
I'm
21, but I have not gone out yet.
Right. So wait, so you just explained to us like how your brain works. So how does that apply to like modern day dating and stuff? Like how can you be thinking about that when you're trying
I'm in a relationship now.
Oh, you have a boyfriend already. Okay.
But it's hard. Whatever. It's really hard. Yeah. I mean, for me, when I was running for office, I didn't date at all. Like I was kind of heartbroken from my high school ex.
Yeah.
And I didn't date at all for like a year and a half. Like no kissing, nothing. Like completely celibate. And then after my campaign ended, I was like, okay, I'm gonna get out there. So I did do Tinder and like start hooking up and I loved being single. Like I think that for a woman in today, it was and growing up in a really sex positive family, being single was really fun, right? And I think in part of like being a survivor of sexual assault, you learn to like disassociate emotions from sex, you know. So for me, I had a lot of fun, and then in the last few months, got into a relationship in August, and now we're living together, and I live with him and like four of his frat mates from college.
What? Amazing.
Yeah. So I live in a grown up frat house, basically. Like they're all now more responsible, but they live together in their frat house at Hopkins. And so that's sort of like I have that fun around me all the time. But it's hard because I mean we get in fights all the time of like we haven't gone on a date in a few weeks because every time we have a date I cancel it because I want to do another phone call.
I
think that it is hard. Like until we started dating, I had never watched a movie without multitasking my email.
Yeah, you gotta do something else.
Yeah, so like watching a movie, even I'm like, oh, this is such a waste of time. Like I could be doing my email while watching this. Like I can be multitasking. So it's and he feels that anxiety. So it's definitely like it's hard.
Yeah.
But I think that it's like good for me right now, especially with traveling so much. Like having stability is really good for my like.
I like that.
That's
I like
what
that,
I say.
I like that. What you consider living with five frat bros stability?
No.
It's like, oh, I'm so glad stable. To be home, and they're just doing kickstands. Oh. I need the stability in my life.
Holy shit.
It is. It's more simple because it's like you it's familiar, you know?
I love it.
That's crazy. Yeah. That's
But it is like he goes out a lot more than I do, and I think that like I definitely like am not part of that culture, their culture in a lot of ways. Sure. Like I have been sort of on a few months of a tea break and not smoking as much and trying to like get on my shit because I'm getting ready to launch like a big national awareness campaign. So I've been trying to really stay on that. But yeah, it's like, I think that it's definitely, it's a pain point.
I want to wrap this up. Talking about Gen Z, man, cause you're Gen Z. You talk about it sometimes. I also know you, are like a chief brand officer for Juve Consulting, right? Which is a marketing firm that's run by purely Gen Zers.
Yeah, I'm like the oldest person on the team.
So Mike and I were both advertising professionals. He's a copywriter. I do like data stuff. And we've actually talked about Juve before.
Yes, we have.
We actually didn't know what it was called.
Yeah. It was in the New York Times.
Yes.
I don't know if they had covered it.
But we just want to learn more about like Gen Z stuff, you know? I mean, all we know about you guys is that you guys love butt stuff. And partying. But that's all we know. And it's like, can you make a marketing company based on those foundations? I don't know. You're about to say, of course, tell us.
So, I mean, I'm very passionate about Gen Z because I think that I think, first of all, we're very big, but we also think very differently from any other generation. Yes. And I know every generation says that, but I really believe that about Gen Z. But like, we're 26% of the global population. So we're the largest segment of a population in the history of the world.
Yeah.
Right? We're 46% of the total media audience. Mm-hmm, so when you think about where companies are marketing to, where brands are marketing to, where all this media is going, we're almost a majority of that audience, right? Especially, I think we are a majority on social media. But also, like, we're a generation that looks at the world and feels more individual responsibility for our legacy and solving the issues around us than ever before, right? Mm-hmm. Like, there's this sort of across-the-board frustration with the systems that govern us and what's around us, and feeling like we have a way to solve it, right? Like, I sort of think of it, I think the defining mentality difference between millennials and Gen Z is, like, millennials want a seat at the table, Gen Z wants to flip the table, right? Like, not only about being inclusive, but saying, this table and system is not working for us.
Yes, like, so my drunk dad. Boom.
But I think there's that, but also there's a sort of this connotation of more inclusivity. So one of our nicknames is the plurals, right? Because we think not in terms of I and advocating for individuals, but thinking about us as a whole group, right? And thinking about what's best for us. And we are the generation that's rejecting labels and gender and race as social constructs. And one of our other nicknames is the genderless generation, because less than 50% of us identify as totally heterosexual or cisgender. Mm. Right. So there's these more connotations of inclusivity. And then even in politics, inclusivity plays a part in that too, because there's a study, I was actually at South by Southwest talking about Gen Z in politics. And we were kind of celebrating the study that just came out that said over 54% of Gen Z favor a socialist society over a capitalist one, right?
Yeah.
And I believe that that's not because we understand what socialism is, but because to us, socialism is social democracy, which is really, you know, being inclusive for people who are more disadvantaged, right? So I think that there's this push of more inclusivity and being more innovative, and you know, social media becomes like an extension of ourselves, not just a tool we use, but kind of like a part of us and how we express ourselves. And having a social media account and a Finsta and multiple social media accounts becomes a regular part of our lives. And like, our average attention span is 8 seconds, and I think in those ways
I can't tell if you're bragging or
I think
being
it's
sad,
really amazing. Like, it's a little jump from ideas. So I think that to me, Gen Z represents a lot of like what we have to do in terms of politics, in terms of how we brand ourselves. And and that's why like social impact is a trendy thing for brands to do now. So so Juve has grown a lot, and we work at Anyframe, because from small companies all the way to Unilever brands, American Express, you know, BET, NBC. So we're working with some big clients who basically hire us to like better understand Gen Z.
Yeah, I love that, because I do, you know, you'll hear from millennials and people older than us are like, oh, these young kids are like so sensitive. Jerry Seinfeld had that article where he no longer does college comedy shows, because he thinks your generation is too sensitive. But like, sensitive is not the right word, right? You're just like more open to different options. You don't like labels. And so like, I do a lot of college shows, but I've never struggled with that, because identity is the one thing I've always kind of struggled with growing up, you know? Yeah. So in a way, I kind of like relate to them. But
do you see that the stand-up comedy that's trending now is sort of the self-deprecating humor of talking about struggling with identity?
100%.
Too,
it's all point of view stuff. Yeah. It's like, what's your story as a half Haitian, half Japanese single mom or something like that? You know, it's like, tell me that's it's all
and
about
like joking about your own race.
Absolutely.
Or like Hannah Gadsby's Nanette.
Yep.
God, I love that so much.
So
but I think that was really eye-opening, and also calling out stand-up comedy as something that does perpetuate self-deprecating humor and all of that too. But I think stand-up comedy is really like, actually Period is a big fan of stand-up comedy, because, and I write about this in my book, I wrote a whole chapter about how like period humor is like one of the ways you break stigma.
Yeah.
And it's like how you get people to talk about uncomfortable things. And so actually our gala every year, our theme is stand up for periods. And last year we had Margaret Cho. This year we're trying to get Ali Wong. And we build our whole gala around stand up comedy.
That's amazing. She's already booking comedy shows.
Booking shows way better than us. If you need someone to hate at your show, invite us. I remember after Parkland, there was a movement, a lot of young people from that school doing things for gun violence and that sort of thing. And I'm so tired, so I'm more than willing to let some young people with energy go and do some stuff. And I think it's awesome, because I've seen a lot of things where people say things are going to change, and I think I saw a millennial, I guess I'm a millennial, and
barely
we're barely but I mean, here's the thing, is that like, yeah, everyone was gonna say, well, everything's gonna change. Yeah. We gotta wait. The old hacky joke is that, oh, we gotta wait for old people to die. Yeah. And then everything's gonna be different.
Yeah.
It's not that different yet.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Also, because I think those millennials become old people, and then
I agree.
But also, the reaction of millennials to being mad at the system was not to participate, right? This kind of connotation of,
absolutely,
fuck the system, it's not working, so I'm not going to vote. You know?
Yes, there is a lot of that, and you know, society has a tendency to replicate itself over and over again. So I'm. You know, a new challenger has appeared, Generation Z.
So this is like Super Smash Brothers.
And I'm super excited. I mean, after seeing, you know, what happened after Parkland, and seeing people, you know, get galvanized and more people being aware of climate change or what have you, I'm like a little optimistic, which is like not at all how I've been feeling for the last like 10 years or so. I think because of the reasons you've been talking about.
Yeah.
So I'm super, super stoked.
Yeah, this.
I think that's one of the reasons why it's hard for me to go back to Harvard too, because like I'm on a leave of absence right now. And
flex.
Also, ultimate flex.
Flex.
You flexed on the hot girl.
You flexed on Harvard.
Yeah, exactly.
Hey, Harvard, I don't have time for you.
I don't know what you're. No, I'm stuck with business.
Like, there's so much happening in the world, and that's how I felt like that. Why I needed to take time off, because I was never in school, because I'd be in class and be like, why am I here? Like,
I love
there's
that.
So much happening out in the world, and like, I'm not doing. Like, and I know my mom's like, okay, it prepares you to do more. But like, for me, I was just getting so frustrated with myself.
Yeah.
So I would have been in the opposite. I would have gone to class and then taken a nap. But so.
In conclusion, what's your like general advice to like, to fellow Gen Zers, you know?
Older people like, who are like, just like, what do I do? You know?
I think across the board, and I know I sound like a broken record here, but it's just to like go for it. I know that sounds so simple.
That was a refrigerator magnet.
I know. It sounds like a little bit like a Nike ad, like just do it. Yeah, but like for me, I really feel like I talk to some, like even you guys, right? You want to start your company, right?
Yeah.
All the resources are there. Mm-hmm. You have all the resources. Yeah. You actually don't really need any money. Like there's sometimes a registration fee, but it's not that hard, right? But you just have to do it, right? Yep. And there's so many, I think, hesitations that we have, especially for young people who are constantly asked by society what they want to be when they're older, right? What do you want to be when you grow up? What are you preparing for? Yep. But not like, what do you want to do right now? And so there's all these like connotations of, I don't have enough resources. I don't have what it takes. You know, I don't, like, I'm not in the right place. It's not the right time. And I think so much of it is you just have to like put all that aside and be like, I'm just going to go for it anyways. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I think that mentality needs to happen. I also think that young people recognizing the power and potential that they have, and older people respecting that and making space for young people to rise, is a big part of what we need right now.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Mm. That's why we are getting out of the podcast game. This is now your podcast. Congratulations.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Man, that sunset is gorgeous.
Grill, patio, sunset. Hard to get better than that. Unless you're browsing Carvana's inventory while you soak it all in.
Oh, burger time.
So sit back, get comfortable. Carvana's got thousands of cars under $20,000 just waiting for you.
I could stay here forever.
Carvana, where car buying meets comfort meets convenience. Download the app or visit Carvana.com today.
And we're back with everybody's favorite segment, Das Race News.
Das Race News.
Again, our guest today is Nadia Okamoto from the Period Movement. Today we're going to talk about this college scandal that everybody's been talking about, freaking out on Twitter.
Been crazy.
I'm sure all of you know what's happening, but just a quick synopsis of what's going on. There was a scheme that began in 2011 centered around a Newport Beach college placement firm run by Rick Singer. He's the bad dude. And wealthy parents paid Singer to help their children cheat on college entrance exams and to falsify athletic records of students to enable them to secure admissions to elite schools, including UCLA, USC, Stanford, Yale, and Georgetown, according to court records. And so there were some celebrities who, you know, who got called out for this. And,
shouts to Full House.
Shouts to Full House. Aunt Becky. Aunt Becky. Do you even know Full House?
Yeah.
Do you?
We watched it in like when I was in kindergarten.
out.
I'm surprised you even watched it in kindergarten because it's pretty old.
Yeah. But you know, I mean, people are very, very upset, because I think the argument is that these children took the spots away from like these hardworking middle class people who may have gotten in through just merit.
Right.
So that's the argument. But I think from the Asian community, this was kind of funny because I remember when I first saw this, I was like, bro, you can't even get into USC the traditional way.
Yeah, some of them did name bigger schools, but then like it was like Wake Forest.
Wake Forest. Yeah. I was like, was that worth $6 million,
you're
bro?
You're bribing your way into like the backup school.
Yeah.
That's fucked up, bro. I also don't know. I used to work in SAT prep, and I used to do all that sort of stuff, and we were all on the up and up, and it was like totally, you know. But I saw, you know, it's expensive.
Some bribes?
No, I didn't see bribes. I wish. Yeah. I saw a lot of, you know, you like get in contact with this like upper crust of people who have like a lot of resources on you. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Like the fact that you could even just sending a kid to our regular SAT classes, it's like $1,500.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, that's like a good chunk of money for most families. And on top of that, if you had a tutor or, you know, there is some like college, whatever, you know what I'm saying? But then I feel like, too, if you have all those resources, then you have like a whole other fleet of resources that could help your kid in other ways.
Yeah.
I don't know, for me, and then this whole college admissions thing is like, I don't know, people are really shocked because we keep thinking it's like a big meritocracy. And like once in a while, somebody really worthy, like Nadia, gets into Harvard.
Yeah.
But like I would say most of the time, it's like not. It's
a business.
It's a result of like this whole culture that has like prime somebody to get into a certain school.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? I always used to think too, I'm sorry, you were gonna say something.
No. I was just gonna say, I think for anyone who like is at Harvard or one of these schools, like no one is surprised. Like this culture is there. Like you meet people whose like name is on the building, right? Like that, it's not that this is a new bribery scandal. It's just that it's the first time it's being called out as bribery.
Did you, when you were there, I mean, what did you?
I'm also, I believe that I deserved a place at Harvard, but I'm a legacy kid. My mom went as well.
Oh.
And I recently watched Hasan Minhaj's Patriot Act, and I loved it, the affirmative action one about like Asian students suing Harvard.
Yep.
But it was interesting to hear him call out like the biggest issue of, you know, of people taking spots is legacy kids, right? And I think that from legacy kids and legacy like alumni donating so much money, like that is a form of bribery in many ways. And I think that no one is surprised that this is happening.
When you were there at Harvard, what was your take on like the, you know, that kind of that the student body there, I guess you could say, you know what I'm saying? Like were people kind of like, you know, this is sort of how it is, or is it like I deserve to be here? Or
I mean, everyone has imposter syndrome of like, why am I here? But yeah. I think that you, like Harvard does feel like a big long shot for a lot of people.
Yeah.
And you do meet a lot of students who have like perfect test scores, perfect grades. I did not have either at all, you know? And I think for me, I had that mentality of like, why am I here too, right?
Because you could cut a bitch.
Yeah. I have friends who like did not write their college admissions essay, even from my high school,
wow.
right?
Whose
parents who paid people to like write their college admissions essay or like help them SAT people. Like, I think it's an unfair system that like I could barely pay to take the SAT twice,
right?
And twice is a lot for someone's low income.
Yeah.
I'm on full financial aid at Harvard. But like, I mean, I had friends who like paid $300 a week for the coaching alone, right? Did it for 3 years in a row. Like, I think it's a whole unfair system. So for bribery to be called out in this, like, no, I was not surprised.
Yeah. And the New York Times had a whole thing about, they had this really crazy article about like, you know, this is just the wrong way to bribe someone.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? It's like, there's other ways you could do it. You know?
They said it was anywhere from like 200,000 to 6 million.
Yeah.
It's 6 insane. Million.
You could build like a library or something.
Yeah.
Then you could just get in by donating
or something. Just get in that way or whatever. Or just don't go to college and use the money
to start a business.
To, you know, bribe the president of Colombia.
The
actual country.
Yeah,
and then,
you got
this whole illegal thing going on. So, I mean, I don't know. Like, it's super fucked up. But, like,
but you know what's interesting is reading the follow up of what's happening to the students who bribed in.
They're not getting in trouble, though, right?
No, some are, right? Because it's considering lying on your admissions.
Dang.
Right? So, lying on your application is an issue. Right, so I don't think any decisions have been made. I was listening to NPR yesterday about this, but I think some students are being talked about their admission being revoked, right? Not on misbehavior, because you can't actually, it's not an issue of the honor code because it that happened before they were admitted, but it's an issue of lying on your admissions.
Wow. Can you imagine being kicked out of Wake Forest for that?
Dude, I imagine if you get kicked out from Wake Forest, there's like a line of Asian moms just getting there to roast you. Boy,
yeah, you are terrible. Wow. Well, I guess we'll just, I don't know, keep tracking
so
this.
I want to open a conversation about like this cheating thing, right? So like we all were in high school. We saw, I mean, going back to like, oh, you had friends who wrote their, you had friends' parents who wrote their essays for them, right? I remember in third grade specifically, we had like a science project and this Indian kid, everybody else brought their science kit and it looked like a third grader built the fucking thing. Yeah. I built a volcano. It looked like shit because I was nine and my motor skills were not good. I don't know. You know, I'm stupid. But this one kid brought in like the best badass volcano. And I remember the teacher had to have a talk with the parent because it was very evident that his mom made it for him.
Oh,
you know?
I see. Yeah.
And so I don't know. Like, what are your thoughts on like that kind of shit, you know? Anywhere from that to like people cheating on tests. You know, I remember when I was in college or in high school, there'd be like somebody who took the class before would be like, I would have
the test.
And, you know, I would like look at it and stuff. You know what I mean? Like, what are your thoughts on that? Yay, nay, gray area?
I think it exists everywhere. I mean, it was at my high school too. Like, we had multiple exams canceled my junior year because people were pre-writing the answers and uploading them so they would work on the test before because we all had the test.
Yeah.
And the issue is that it was math. Everyone did it.
Yeah.
Right? And it was so normalized. But I think another thing that's rising now is like the use of Adderall and how like people count that as academic dishonesty. So that was a big scandal in my high school as well in junior year, right? For like kids dealing Adderall, like their own Adderall, you know? But I think that it scales. I mean, I definitely was guilty of cheating throughout high school. Like, I mean, I had to withdraw from Chinese class for cheating my senior year after I got into Harvard, right?
That's so
there's a big W for withdrawal, right?
Oh, shit. But they still let you into Harvard, though.
Well, my school is just like, we'll withdraw. Like, it's a big W, right?
But I think
that for me, it was so normalized, and which is awful. And the stakes weren't very high, especially in middle school.
What happens
when you get caught for cheating when you're in like in elementary school, you know?
Well, we had a friend, Brian Park. He went to a very prestigious school and he just cheated on a science test by having access to a previous version of the test, right? And he got kicked out.
Yeah, that's like, I think that's the thing with college is the stakes are much higher.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
You never once looked at somebody's.
I have a tremendous amount of honor.
Yeah, I was gonna say, I think you never cheated.
I have a tremendous amount of honor in that aspect.
Yeah,
those are like the two things. I'm kind of okay with like, I could see myself killing somebody, but I would never steal. I don't know, it's weird.
You
would never steal.
No, I don't like stealing.
Well, I went through a big stealing phase.
Are you from the Bronx?
I was sent to therapy for it because it was that mentality of like when you suddenly don't have money, you feel like you want things, and
so
I literally had to go to therapy because I felt like stealing things that I didn't need was like proving to myself that I could take care of myself, right? So I actually had like a very, and I have a very addictive personality, so it was actually really dangerous because I started stealing things and I was very good at it, you know? So it was, and I think it's, I didn't have a lot of remorse for it.
Yeah.
So it was something that I had to learn to have. Like learning like, this is not okay. This does hurt something, you know?
Well, I'm going to keep my phone near me now.
So this is the weird thing is when I was going through that phase, I would never steal from anyone.
Someone you know.
Someone I know, or you know, someone other person. I would never steal someone else's.
You steal from like a store,
yeah.
like a nameless
a
entity.
Chain,
yeah.
like a,
that's
like
how
a,
it starts.
A big capitalist corporation, right?
Like, every criminal has a code, though. You know,
everyone does
Dexter.
Nobody.
I don't kill family.
Okay, cool, Nadia.
That's the thing. It's crazy, but I think that's why it's like in our like. I think it's sort of part of human nature. Like people figure out ways to game the system.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Like it is part of being competitive. So I think it's something that you learn and condition yourself to know is not okay.
You know what we should do, Nadia? Is we should get some way to combine your kleptomania with period power.
Yes.
We should be stealing period
products and get
from
them
the rich. You know, if somebody rolls up, you can roll up right now into the CVS and just be like, these motherfucking products are mine. You know, fuck your tax. You know, fuck your prices. You know what I'm saying? Yes. Oh, you, I am now on your board. Thank you very much. That was amazing. And we're back with our guest, Nadia Okamoto. We're going to play a... we're gonna play games now.
Hell yeah.
And so we've come up with some games inspired by this scandal recently, we've come up with a game called College Application Consultant. So You, Nadia, are a college application consultant here to spin the lack of accomplishments of your clients' children into compelling stories ripe for college admissions officers. So using your skills in branding and the fact that you got into Harvard, spin these terrible stories. So for example, you have a client. Okay, imagine I'm your client, right? Okay, I have a daughter. She's amazing. Okay.
Hi.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm in the room.
She's great. I think she should totally get into Wake Forest, but she has never had a job. Is there a way to spin that so that's actually a good thing?
Yeah, for sure. Ooh. I mean, this is most of my friends at Harvard. Yeah. I mean, she probably never had a job because she was doing so much work volunteering for her community. Ooh. Or taking care of like a dying relative or, you know,
dying,
doing art.
We're bringing death into the game? Like, goddamn!
I think that there was no time for having a job because she was caring for the people around her.
Wow.
That's
you're
incredible.
Almost too good at this.
You're
too freaking me out. Okay, how about here's another one. Blake is on JV lacrosse but has never played in a game.
Athletics is not a priority of his. He's too into science.
This is scary. I want to go home.
Okay, one more. Let's do. Yeah, you're killing this game. One more. Spence got a DUI.
Spence got a DUI, but learned from it, and now is advocating nationally against drinking while driving.
Ooh, all I can
and
say,
he started a nonprofit for it too.
All I can say, Nadia, is I'm glad you're on our side. All right, that was awesome that you passed the game with flying colors. That's amazing.
I got this other game. This one's called you are a master of nonprofit. You run one yourself. You have a lot of experience in it. I think you can identify a good business when you hear about one. This one's called which nonprofit would you invest in? I've got some business ideas that Mike and I want to pitch to you. Okay.
Okay.
These are all nonprofits. Okay, this one is a nonprofit sex education organization focusing mainly on anal sex for the Gen Z population.
What is this myth that Gen Z loves anal sex?
We hear it in the rap songs.
I've literally never heard this.
Grocery? Remember that?
You got it?
What's the song?
Oh, yes.
But that's not anal sex. That's foreplay.
Oh, okay,
look, for her, it's not
play,
even
ass play.
That's just normal.
That's just normal.
It's so normal. It's just like just foreplay. It's just foreplay.
You get your coffee, you eat your ass, you go to work.
It's no big deal.
You fix the printer.
You know what I'm saying?
What's up?
How else are you supposed to say hello to somebody?
Okay, so that's one. That's choice number one. Anal sex education organization. This is another organization that provides self defense classes against Asian moms. Because I got beat up a lot as a kid, and the key is you can't hurt her because she's your mama, but you gotta dodge her blows, you know, because you're trying to live your life.
Yeah, that's a good one.
I wrote this one because the other day I had a flashback of I was in Japan one summer and my mom was making me do worksheets, Japanese worksheets,
yeah, yeah.
In addition to my American homework, and I didn't want to do it. And I was being a dick, and I was like, I don't do this anymore. And she grabbed my leg. I was like 9. She just dragged me across my grandma's house, and my head was just banging against the floor.
Oh,
so I was like,
man.
Had I had this organization, I could.
Also, a special ability to defend against being attacked by a shoe.
Yes. Slipper. Yeah. That's the slippers or the modern day ninja stars for Asian moms. You know.
Would you invest in this nonprofit? Yes,
so that's choice number
that's
two.
Number two.
And number three is it's like Birthright. But we take white people to all the countries their ancestors colonized and make them work off the debt. Those are your three choices.
Wow.
This is Shark Tank, but for nonprofit.
Yeah, what do you think?
I think I would invest in the first one.
Oh. The oil? Oh, see?
Yeah.
Because
no, but I think it's because acknowledging that kids are doing it and they should be safe about it. So the sex education is like, you know, how to be safe and preventative about things. But I think that the second one, the issue is that I feel like having self-defense against your mom, if that's part of kind of the cultural upbringing, might provoke more violence.
Oh, I might get too strong.
And I think the third one already exists through volunteerism.
Oh,
that's true. That's
right.
And it's a profitable industry. These rich white kids pay money to go work and make houses in countries their ancestors
and
colonized.
Might as well make money.
It's a genius system because like their ancestors destroyed the houses and then they get to go and build houses.
Yeah.
See? And it keeps going.
I already had a marketing plan for this. I was going to market it like Firefest. You know, have hot girls in like poor parts of Thailand.
Yeah, exactly.
Like,
oh, you know what I'm saying? They're all like, help me build this house.
Help me
build
this house.
But don't you think that already exists? Haven't you seen something like that? You know what I mean? Like, I think that nonprofit, it could be a more strong business, more profitable business.
I love this. She's like, you're not original.
No, you know what she's saying, that this shouldn't even be a nonprofit. This should be for profit.
Yeah.
That business mentality.
So that's great that you're an advocate for ass play. That's good.
That's
good.
That's fantastic.
Let this be on the record. All right, everybody, that was episode 56. We hope you enjoyed it. Again, our guest today was Nadia Okamoto from the Period Movement. Nadia, is there anything you'd like to plug?
I would just say you can stay updated with me at Nadia Okamoto on social or at Period Movement with that work. And you can find my book, Period Power, anywhere books are sold. Amazon is easiest.
Hell yeah, dude. And then you can also find us on social, as she says, at Asian Not Asian Pod. And you can also find me, Fumi Abe, at The Fumi Abe. That's T-H-E-F-U-M-I-A-B-E.
You can find me on Instagram at Nice Pants Bro, and I don't have a book, so there you go. You can find that wherever books are not sold.
You guys should write a book.
We should write a book. We're going to.
Actually, one of my book projects right now for my next one is about Asian American identity.
Wow, yeah. Is it about straight Asian guys? Because we're really good at doing that.
Where is it about boring ass straight Asian dudes with hoodies on? Because that's our angle.
We also want to plug our Hack City show. We have a monthly comedy show that we do here at the Canal Street Market, 265 Canal Street, every third Wednesday. The next one is March 20th, so it's going to be two days.
Oh,
it's gonna be 2 days. It's coming up.
Oh,
8 o'clock. You should come.
Yeah, come.
It's really fun.
I wanna come.
We have a DJ. We got good food.
Oh, I must come.
Yes. Let's,
bring your frat bros with you.
Yeah. Yes, so that's gonna be at 8 o'clock. Come at 7:30 because it gets packed. That's every third Wednesday. Check us out. Our ticket link is in our bio on our Instagram. You don't even need a ticket. You can just show up. But actually, get a ticket because we're probably going to run out of seats. Anyways, also, please donate to us on Patreon. You can find us at patreon.com/asiannotasianpod. And you can have access to bonus content. And also leave a review on iTunes. That always helps. Say something funny and give us 5 stars.
And thank you again to our guest, Nadia.
Yes, thank you so much for Realsies. For not cutting us. And for just showing up and be part of the show. We really appreciate
it,
man.
Thanks for having me.
Very busy lady. So any last remarks for our guest, Mike?
Oh man, I've got so much Googling to do. That's it. That's all I know.
Yeah. All right, everybody. Have a good day. Bye.
This episode of Asian Not Asian is presented in partnership with Listening Party. Follow the crew on Instagram at Listening Party Presents and at Canal Street Market.